hearing the Labor and Business Affairs Committee, February 20, 1975.
Ready?
They're having a caucus, you'll be due by 4.
House Labor Committee will come to order. We don't have any sticker bills before us. We have some information on CETA funds, which we thought we should check into and see what's going on. So all we're doing is just trying to get a little bit of information this morning. And we'll start with Mr. Dowdis and Lane Community College. Go ahead.
Okay. A situation that we've had recently at the college occurred concerns a CETA.
Would you give us your name and your position first?
I'm sorry. My name is Henry Dowdis. I am the Director of Personnel Services at Lane Community College. The situation that has occurred to us involving the college recently is wherein a person being funded under the CETA program was apparently referred by a private referral employment agency and was charged the usual going rate for the employment service. The question or problem that we perceive from the college's point of view is a lack on our part of a formal document being issued to the employment service requesting a service. And secondly, the questions that come up as far as our responsibility to an employee funded under a federal program and the resulting charge to this person who has had to qualify for the program by being out of work for an extended period and the attendant things that go along with such a long history of being out of work, such as absence of money. To describe in particular the situation, the young lady we at the college did not know that she had been referred by an employment agency. Really couldn't have cared less. We advertised our CETA positions according to affirmative action guidelines, letting as many people as we can know to make sure that we're complying in respect to those rules. Some days later, the representative from the Department of Employment came out on a site visit, talked to the young lady, and then found out that the charge had been dropped on her for finding a job.
Say that again?
Well, in talking with her on a site visit, asked, how she was doing on the job and checked for our compliance with the rules of hiring under CETA. And as a part of that conversation, learned that she had been charged by a local employment service for finding her the job. Then came our involvement from the personnel office end and from the administrative portion of the college, wondering if we in truth had done everything we could to comply with the rules, and if really there was some rule against her being charged for placement, when in truth she'd been hired under a very specialized funding pattern to alleviate employment. We inquired, and I know that the Department of Employment representatives inquired to find out the legal position as far as her being charged unemployment service fee. There is an ORS 658 something, and pardon me, I'm not real good on the numbering system, but it specifically addresses the obtaining by the employment service of a, in one case it says either verbal or written, and in the very end of that same phrase it says bona fide order for placement. Part of this situation may well be confusion over that which is a bona fide order and that which is a verbal order. We are contacted sometimes 5 and 6 times per day by various employment services. Usually at the start of every week, half the employment agencies in town will call, then ask us very simply, do you have any jobs open? That's fine. And we are a public agency, and we're a very open public agency. And I know that it's been the habit of all of our personnel-oriented people to answer any question asked. To that extent, I, as director of personnel operation right now, do not consider that an order for services. We are in the throes of writing a policy and a procedure, primarily because of this one incident, that will formalize our operation to the extent that no order will ever go out unless it is in writing. The only thing we can do to protect ourselves again, along the lines of affirmative action, along the lines of data hiring rules, and a variety of other outside programs. This young lady has received, apparently, some redress, as much as we have talked with the employment service, and they offered to contact her and attempt to work out some solution that would of lesser monetary cost to her. In general, however, it's my feeling that whether by an administrative rule or by perhaps a new law in the books of the state, this situation does need clarification, and I'm sure as there are more rules at the federal level concerning employment problems, that we'll see even more of a need in the future. If there are any questions, I'd like to take a shot at it.
Representing Rogers?
This interests me, Mr. Gilbert.
Right.
Because about 3 years ago, a young man was involved in a similar situation, was hired with a job order in place. The state agency that licenses these firms got involved in that case in the federal court, and there was a penalty levied. Now, has the state stepped in this particular matter?
To my knowledge, there's been no action from the state. I would also like to say that although from my point of view, I have no knowledge of an order being placed, I cannot say that a person should not have understood that he had an order. If he had been following the college over a period of time, learning of job vacancies, referring to the college, whether or not we said, you know, will you please seek and find an individual, becomes a very skinny thing. And it may well be that he perceived that he did have an order, he, she, or whoever is following that day. In part because of that, I'm sure there's been no real action. We would not initiate any ourselves, because again, I really could not swear in a court of law that no one really ever said to him, would you please find a person? it is not our habit in the seeking of people for highly specialized funding positions, like CETA positions, to contact outside sources. That whole program is based on involvement with the Department of Employment, and that's where we go. And that's a pretty fine line.
Any questions?
Might not be a bad idea, John.
Section we're referring to. This is 658-165, subsection 1. No employment agency shall accept a charge for service from an individual seeking employment or refer an individual to an employer without having first obtained orally or in writing a bona fide order from an employer seeking help, which is to be answered by the individual. So that's the section referred to. So what you're suggesting is perhaps maybe they shouldn't be orally.
In our particular case, I can say that we will develop a procedure that will insist that they not be orally. And we will mail out a copy of the procedure to all of the private employment agencies in the community, informing them that if we don't call you, don't call us.
Well, I'm not sure if you can answer this. I was going to ask, how did the employment service get the listing? You've answered that part. Is there anyone here from that group?
There will be, yes. Yes.
Okay. Okay, then I'll hold on my question.
Representative Rogers?
I might suggest, not being an attorney, that this young lady consult that part and the attorney of the attorney.
I think that's within our purview as employers to suggest that she may have additional regrets. Thank you.
Other questions?
John? The responsibility for the committee, that members that haven't been involved in this before, for the enforcement of that particular section is the Bureau of Labor. And they have, we worked with them during the interim. At the request of the employment agencies themselves, and they are responsible for the enforcement of this. So if, I haven't called them on this because I wasn't sure of what our facts were either, and I didn't want to get them involved in it. But if the committee feels this should be followed up, I can also notify them.
Okay, President.
Well, I certainly think it should, and I'd like to get into this much, much deeper. It really concerns me. And how far something like this could go. I know that there was a lot done in the last session to clean up some of the problems that were in this particular area. But it's a little scary if potentially, like picking up the phone and finding out what jobs are available and then using that as a base to get people out and then get them at the end of the month or couple weeks later with a bill for finding them the job. It concerns me very much. I think we should go ahead full bore on
it. Did this young lady advise you about her filling out a master charge application at the same time?
That was a facet that I failed to mention. Apparently, as part of the transaction within the employment service, immediately after coming to work, they contacted her and made us a charge for their service. And while this gets into some, perhaps, of my value judgment, she was convinced that she should put this on a master charge. And that's wonderful. A very convenient form of financing. But it certainly made those of us who are concerned with the situation at the college feel a little uneasy to the extent that here we have an individual participating in a federal program aimed at getting people employed after considerable hardship and unemployment, and then to charge them for the service of employment seemed certainly a bit strong, and then to find out that they were going to pay interest on it. Really, it's pretty difficult to look at it being helpful to the individual. You know, it's really very difficult.
So,
very
good. She did not state she had been sent by the agency when she came out to the interview? Or?
Not to my knowledge. And one, pardon me for being vague about some of these things, but we have recently reorganized the shop, our personnel assistant, up until the first of this last month, actually operated in three locations in the campus, and it obviously was not in the communication, and in some instances, other personnel may have been filling in for the gallon and that kind of thing, and she may have said something to the cop. To the best of my knowledge, she didn't, but this came out in the conversation with the Department of Employment people.
As I remember it, because I used one several years ago, that they sent out a little slip of paper with your name on it saying that you were referred by or something.
Ordinarily, each individual coming from an employment service does have a card, and we do use employment services incidentally, and are very happy with our relationship with them. If not, if they don't come with a card in hand, then the employment agency comes out, gets our application, and the individual fills out that stamp them with their identity on them, so that we ordinarily do know when a person does come to get employment again. This young lady may have here in the card. I can't say one way or the other.
Question I would ask, I wonder how many times this happened in the past and how often it could happen in the future.
That's an important question. I do know of an earlier incident where there was quite a disagreement with a local employment service over whether or not a person should be charged. And it finally, after a lot of trauma, worked itself out. But the question was one of time. Did that person appear to be college first or the employment agency first? And this took quite a lot of overhead in establishing who got where first. It was determined that the individual had been to the college on their own time before going to the employment service, and after considerable hassle, they were refunded their money. But it's a problem area.
Thank you.
Any other questions? John?
Did this young lady indicate to you whether or not she had a master charge all the time, or whether or not the employment agency had her fill out the application for a master charge there?
No indication.
Anything else?
Thank you.
Thank you, General.
Mr. Butler?
I'm Lyle Sweatland, the Director of Development at Lane Community College. I don't know too many details about the particular case that you're just discussing. That's primarily a Pagoda area. It has been my responsibility for the last 3 or 4 years to ramrod the applications for the manpower program that the college is involved in. The early Emergency Employment Act, the test program, and now the CETA program. And when you opened the meeting, Mr. Chairman, you mentioned that you'd like to know something about CETA, and I think as far as our college is concerned, and our experience with these manpower programs, and to be able to answer some questions about how they've been operating as far as our college is concerned. I'd be happy to do that. But I think Mr. Dota essentially gave us all the facts, as I understand them, regarding the case, the particular case we're talking about.
Sandy Wilhelm.
What type of positions do you place people in that proceed of reason?
They run the gamut all the way from highly trained professional people, counseling, instructors, down through paraprofessionals, teacher aides, custodians, ground people. Gary, you name it, and I guess we've had a seat of person placed in most of the areas of the town. We have about 30 people now on CETA Title II, and some combination of CETA funds and some residual step funds. And we're about to place 10 more on these new Title VI. CETA fund, panic money.
Out of it. Well, you got 30 on payroll now. You'll have 10 more soon.
Right.
For a total of 40. Out of that 40, how many of them would you say are instructors or you use the term something or other professional?
Paraprofessional.
Okay.
The higher paid category.
Yeah, I was not aware that we were using CETA funds to hire college instructors. Maybe I'm ignorant, but I had no idea that a college instructor would be qualified to be hired under the CETA program. But I'm curious how many of the 40 are going to be classified as college instructors or professional people.
Well, of this latest group, very, very few. Without referring to the record, I'd estimate 4 or 5 of the total, all of the involved.
10%.
In the earlier funding, manpower funding, we had most of the earlier group hired under the old earlier funding were instructors. That's where our need was. We had students clamoring at the registration office and no money to hire instructors with. There were thousands of unemployed instructors. And so we hired instructors and were able to accommodate a couple thousand additional students because the funds were available. The funds have been available from the state of Oregon, and we've hired instructors for state funds.
Only
reimbursement.
Yeah. Okay. You don't know what particular position that this. Maybe I missed it in early previous testimony. What particular position was this young lady applied to at the school?
The clerk position. Could I verify that the building? Do you know their title? The clerk position.
Clerk.
Business.
Thank you.
Representative Rogers.
Wasn't there recently quite a controversy involving LCC and hiring a high-located individual?
Yes.
That the committee would be interested in and come up with.
Well, the particular case is still not settled. It has been referred from region. Regional office of the Department of Labor back to Washington, D.C. for final disposition. But there was a question raised by some individuals in our community about the propriety of hiring a counselor, a mental health aid person, which would be in the higher categories that the field representative asked about a moment ago. She was hired through the regular hiring procedures of the college. and met all of the CETA qualifications for eligibility, all of CETA guidelines, and were, as a matter of fact, was approved by the county CETA organization, and we have written approval to hire her from the county organization of CETA. And so we did hire her, and after a screening process in which she was involved in the competition with at least six or seven other persons, the college was satisfied that she was the best qualified person for the job as far as the college was concerned, regardless of what kind of money she was going to hire. But, and as much as she was approved by the county organization, we did hire the person, and it was later that the question of propriety was brought up by some citizens in the community. And the question was referred to Region 10 for a ruling, and they've now passed it on to Washington, and I don't know when we'll get a final ruling on this particular individual. But in the meantime, she's continuing to work, and Mr. Divis from the regional office has told us that the status quo is being maintained as far as her employment is concerned until we get a ruling from Washington.
Was the controversy that was raised on this due to the fact that her husband had something to do with the county approval?
That's right. The people who are raising the question are charging violation of the federal definition of nepotism. The college has become sort of a bystander in the controversy as other people argue the pros and cons. We feel that we're fully justified in the actions in the way we conducted ourselves, and awaiting the outcome of the decision from Washington, D.C. now.
But her salary level is something like $13,000 or $14,000 a year.
Yes, a little over $13,000. As I said, I might clear up that point because I sense it coming. In the past several years, in all the CETA funding and other manpower programs too, I believe the agency doing the hiring, because of the $10,000 a year limitation of CETA funds, the local agency can, if they have the funds, supplement that. It's permitted to supplement the individual salary. And so that sometimes enables us to get a more highly trained, qualified person on staff if we have $2,000 or $3,000, or sometimes it's a few hundred dollars to supplement the CETA funds. And we do that. I've done that in several cases. We don't have the dollars to pay the full salary for the person, but with the CETA funds, we can put someone to work.
Maybe this isn't your specialty, but do you feel that all of your CETA hiring could be handled by the State Employment Division?
Could it be?
Could it be? Should it be?
I mean, once the college lists the position that we'd like to have filled with CETA funds, we would just tell the Employment Service about it and then have them fill it. I don't think the college would be satisfied with that procedure, not because we don't trust the judgment and the very fine people in the Employment Service, but because our supervisors, the immediate supervisors and the people to be hired, would want to have a final, would want to be in a position to make the final decision among the group of applicants. I think in the final analysis, only they know what kind of a person they want to fill a particular slot. and they should be able to. They should be able to be involved in that decision.
But doesn't the employment division send out people looking for jobs?
That's right.
Would meet your qualifications, and then you do the interviewing and would hire from the individuals that they would send out?
That's the way it has worked, and it has worked well for the police with that decision.
I don't understand why you feel it wouldn't be satisfactory.
I'm just saying the final decision was, I understood your question to mean that if we would just tell them that we needed a person to, in a particular department, we needed a secretary in a particular department, or an instructor in the science department.
To fill a seat of a...
fill a seat of front of division. And then the employment service would survey the applicants that they have and send us one. And if that's what you're saying, that's what I'm objecting to.
I'm saying say one. Sending one. Wouldn't they send two or three or four or half a dozen?
Yeah, that's the way it has been working, and as far as I'm concerned, that's a satisfactory arrangement, as I say, has been working well. I misunderstood your question. I thought you were suggesting.
Oh, it would be satisfactory procedure.
Well, it's been working.
But something went wrong here. Like in this other particular case,
we weren't even aware of it.
Right, I realize that.
It came to light when the two gentlemen from the employment service started to do monitoring of their follow-up monitoring of the people who were placed. And they always do this. We get lots of monitoring and auditing and follow-up on these.
So, okay, in other words, then you agree that these jobs could be filled by the employment division.
Yes.
They could send out the individuals that you would like to interview and fill these seats of funding.
In most cases, in some instances where people with the desired qualifications are not available to the employment service, they're perfectly willing that we then use our own resources to try to find the individual. And the college, as a matter of fact, has a file cabinet full of hundreds or maybe even thousands of applications for employment. And we can also use those. The advantage of having employment service pre-screening them is that it eliminates some of the elements of decision making from us as to whether the person is a bona fide qualified applicant, whether they have indeed been unemployed for the required length of time or underemployed and meet all the other regulations. We'd rather have some of that responsibility on their back than that on ours.
I'm sure you can't answer this, but I think I'm going to need an answer on it. As I understand, I think the employment division has thought CETA funding for some jobs in preparation for...
They're here.
Okay.
I know they have.
Representative Willen, I get off on a tangent, Mr. Chairman. Bring me back on the road, would you? I want to pursue something. Calling on your experience, Mr. Sweatman, you say we established a while back that four or five positions out of the 30 or 40 could be professional people, college instructors. How does a college instructor become unemployed? I mean, that's typical.
Yeah.
These four or five, what's the common reason that a college instructor becomes unemployed?
Well, I expect that a number of the reasons are the same reasons that anybody else in any other occupation becomes unemployed. People move into the community, particularly the university community like we are, sometimes with their spouses who are like graduate students at the university, and they themselves, the other spouse, is a well-qualified person to maybe with experience to instructors. Sure.
So they brought their unemployment with them.
That would be one example.
Is that what you said? They brought their unemployment with them. They're unemployed because they relocated in Eugene, Oregon. They weren't living in Eugene, Oregon. Became unemployed.
Well, that would be one example that that has happened.
Well, did any of these four or five people reside in Eugene and become unemployed and then were put back on a payroll with CETA funds like I was always under the impression the CETA funds were intended for? Or were these CETA funds used to pick up some additional college instructors, which if were, you know, the taxpayers felt were necessary, they would have authorized you to hire through other means? And I'm not trying to pick on Lane Community College. I'm trying to educate myself on the CETA program, and I'm all of a sudden finding out the CETA program is, in my opinion, being abused, not by you, it's because of the way it's laid out, evidently. But were any of these four or five instructors native people to the area who became unemployed because of the economic situation, or did they all bring their unemployment in with them?
Under the regulations and guidelines, I were not required to look that deeply into their
probably
can't into why they became unemployed, and we would only find that out incidentally. There, we do have to determine that they meet the CETA qualifications as an unemployed person.
What are they? Could you quickly just relate that to us?
Well, the most obvious are the being unemployed for 30 days and seeking employment. And I work with them every day. I know that there's some. If you want the legal details about it, I suggest when your employment service people come up that they...
I'm not trying to put you on the spot. Yeah. I'm just trying to learn a little more about this program.
But they may have a copy of the regulations with them and could quote the list of qualifications, but I mean that they do. They do need to determine that they're bona fide unemployed people and have been unemployed for the specified period of time that they are, that their residency requirement is to be a resident of the area which the law requires. So those are the two big ones.
Just one more question. To your knowledge, is any other institution of higher education in the state of Oregon utilizing CETA funds to hire faculty?
I think we were the first and most extensive, the institution that made most extensive use of it, and our probably maybe because our budget squeeze was tighter than other institutions.
You're not aware of any other institution doing it, or you were just the first? Just trying to establish if any other
I can't really speak to the four-year institutions. I know that in the first round of funding, I'm quite sure that we were the only community college to hire instructors. I don't know whether some of the others have done it since. I don't know.
Thank you very much.
But it enabled us to admit many more students to the campus, which we were not able to before we got the funding.
Any questions?
Well, I don't think it's a question. You always hold it up. Okay, thanks, Bob.
Thank you.
Mr. Packenbacker?
Thank you.
Both come at once if you like.
Yes, sir.
Well, I said miss because you signed up for it.
Ladies first.
Both come up together, sorry. Signed up for it.
Well, that's okay.
No discrimination.
I'm Ann Packenbacker. I'm Packenbacker's placement agency here in Salem, Oregon. So we're in the Marion Polk County CETA district, different from the Lane. But I think there seem to be two questions here. And one is addressing ourselves to immediate problems that Mr. Dota is speaking to and the placement of a person under this program at Lane Community College and the circumstances under which it happened, and the other is the Fraud and Employment Agency position in this program, if there should be one, and if not, why not? And first, I am privy to the name of the agency that was involved in the Lane Community College placement, and I contacted the owner because the thing that distressed me right away was the fact that this supposedly was a placement that occurred without a bona fide job order. And since our last law went into effect in 73, we've been very, very tightly regulated. If there's anything that we have, we've got records right down to the dot and tittle of what happens to every placement. And I called the owner, and the person, the story he gave me is that this is on job order number 1708, listed with him on November 27, 1974, by Carol Beckley in the Personnel Department of Lane Community College, Secretary One position, at a salary of $560. There's no mention at this time that this job was funded by the CETA program. They went ahead and filled it, and the job was filled in December, I think about 16th. And the applicant did pay the fee and paid it on a master charge, but I don't know what mechanics were there. But if it does happen, and to our mind, there's nothing wrong with this at all. The applicant was interviewed by the CETA people, I believe, in the follow-up that was mentioned, and it was discovered that she was placed through a private employment agency. And then I believe that Mr. Einan and Mr. Dota had a conference call with his owner, explained to him what the situation was, and this is the first time that the agency owner was aware that a CETA position was involved here. And so we asked what would be appropriate, and they suggested that he cut the fee in half, which he did, and he refunded the balance of the fee immediately. I'd like to say that, and we've been aware of the CETA program just recently also in our office, and it happened, he placed an applicant and a position in Staten, and there was no mention at all that this was a funded CETA position until we had a letter several months after the position had been filled advising us that it was under this program and that private employment agencies were not to be considered a part of it. And so I immediately called Staten and tried to get to the bottom of it, and the bottom of it was that nobody, they had several treasurers in the interim, nobody passed on the word, nobody advised us, this was a lack of communication completely. And so we offered to have the gal come back, and we just would place her free again, and she never came back, and I think she's being replaced by the CETA program elsewhere, because she was a previous participant in the program. Then, just the other day, after all this discussion, why we had a call from the Willamette 14 program, Willamette Valley, listing a job, and he's very open, said they can see the positions available and we need an accounting clerk. So having had a previous experience, we asked the person was listing the job order, please call Mr. Freeze, who is the head of the manpower consortium here. And he said, no way, that they use private employment agencies. And so that was the end of that as far as we were concerned. And we went further to find out, you know, what it is that qualifies somebody under this program. And it's very interesting, and particularly with the fact that maybe, well, maybe it varies county to county, but it would seem to me that a instructor at a university would hardly come under this. One is the initial target here, anyway, seems to be unemployed, ineligible for unemployment compensation, a veteran of the Vietnam War. That's the primary target. Then get down into secondary qualifications, unemployed for 30 days, not collecting unemployment, minority group, deprived educationally, deprived economically, resident of Marion Polk County, and previous participant in the program. I would like to ask questions from you about the actual mechanics of the of the placement at this insurance yard. Recruiting positions are as much a part of our job for qualified applicants as filling the place job where it is called in. We do understand that. That we do get very qualified people coming in, signing up for our services. If we don't happen to have a job that's suitable on our books, we will go to that and spend a great deal of time and effort to find a suitable job, an appropriate place that fits their qualifications, which is very much a part of our business. And it could easily have happened that as it was said, that Mr. Dota said he gets called from unemployment agency. You have any openings today? This would be something I would expect to happen.
Doctor, I'd like to ask you one question. Our information coming from the lady involved, she filled out a master charge application at the request of the employment agency to pay the fee. Do you think that's proper procedure?
Well, it's an avenue open to the financing of this is quite a sizable purchase, and if they are willing to do it, I see nothing wrong with it. We haven't done it in our office, but if somebody does have a Bank America card, we'll be glad to accept it.
Oh, this isn't what I said.
I know what you're saying. What is your reservation about?
Well, it just seems to me for going to an employment agency and finding a job, which is quite obvious, you're out of work or you wouldn't be in there to find a job, and then have the agency ask. You fill out a master charge card when you don't have one and charge their fee. It just, I don't know.
Well, you know, not everybody comes into our offices as deprived economically. We have many people who are on the job or switching. We have many people who have reserves or access to funds. And, I think that's an individual decision. I don't think there's anything wrong with it, no.
I might say that I'm very adverse to charge accounts.
All right.
I think that's one of the worst things ever happened to this country.
I do. Right. I agree.
Beyond a doubt.
Well, they abolished slavery, so they had to come up with something.
I guess.
What was the fee? My concern now, and some of the comments that you've made, are the CETA policy. I'm certainly going to look into that. I don't particularly like the idea. You made it. Statement that the employment agency can call, in this case, Lane Community College, and casually say, what job openings do you have? Is that what you're...
Yes, they can call. Excuse me, they don't casually call, though, because the law says you must identify yourself as an employment agency.
Right. Okay, that's what the
right.
Okay. So then they call, identify themselves. Do you have any job openings? It would be basically the question.
No, well, it wouldn't even be as casual as that. They normally not call unless they had an applicant whom they felt Lane County Community College could use, who perhaps is the kind of person they've employed before, and they usually present an applicant.
Okay, I think I'm getting two different answers here. Previous testimony was that it was felt at least that Lane Community College didn't know that when they received this call and said, yes, we do have some job openings, that they in fact were placing a request for a job, someone to fill these jobs.
Well, that would be very hard for somebody in a personnel department who used to handling this type of a situation. When the caller has identified himself as a private employment agency, we have this townhouse secretary, have you got any opening? For that personnel person in Lane Community College, say, well, yes, we do, and in our job order, you have to describe the skills. You have 100 questions to answer to fill in the job order. It would be unbelievable to me that at the end of this interrogation, Lane Community College didn't know the job order.
Okay, now let me ask you this. Have you, in your business, or do you know of other cases where placement agencies have went through, let's say, the newspaper and run down a listing and picked out one and put it in their file and then used that as a...
They may have done it in previous to 73, but it would be very hard to do it anymore.
But it could be done.
You always have that time when the applicant has to go and the applicant has to take a job referral document. And on this job referral document, it's every... Just the whole thing spelled out all over again.
Well, two things here that have come to my attention that concern me is, can an employment agency arbitrarily send out people to these positions to seek employment and then charge them when in fact there has never been a request for that service from the employer?
Yeah.
And the other thing, which I'm very concerned about now, you mentioned that couple of things that have occurred is the policy that CETA has on filling these positions and using employment agencies or the state employment division. And we're talking about federal funds and what I thought, and I share some of Representative Wilhelm's concerns here about how these funds are being filled and for what job reasons they are. My concern, I think, mainly is on residential requirements, and if we're going out and picking up people to fill these vacancies and maybe abusing the CETA program. I think I asked a question there someplace at the first, but do you agree that this is a procedure that could be used? Or I think you maybe tend to disagree with what Lane Community College says was the procedure.
Well, I don't think you find today that the climate agencies will go through and pick out somebody else, you know, a listing in a paper that say Lane Community College has put in advertising. It's against us because perhaps the applicant, it would be very difficult to collect a fee from an applicant if an ad was running publicly for the same job you were referring to. I'd like to say also that the agency in Eugene did call Bob Lortz of the Wage and Hour Employment Agency Division here to clear this, and he felt that there was no reason why we shouldn't participate in the CETA program. Is there a statute that says that employment agencies shall not be used? I think this is more the issue here today, isn't it? That whether the employment agency
shall
participate or not, is that what the real issue is?
Probably basically.
Isn't it?
Whether CETA funds should be spent for a fee for job funding. This, of course, is part of the complaint.
What do you do?
Yeah.
We're just trying to find out.
I'd like Gary to speak to this.
Certainly.
Excuse me. I'd like to say something on that point. My name is Gary Tigenstecker. I'm a co-owner of Tigenstecker Placement Agency here in town, but I also represent the Oregon Association of Employment Services, Incorporated. The particular agency which was involved in this situation was not a member of our association, so I do not want to become involved personally or with the association in this particular instance, which has been under discussion. But I would like to make the point, which so often seems to get lost, which is that the private employment process, and by process I mean not only the employment agencies, but all the elements of the process, including the employer, that this process is a very important resource to the state of Oregon and the people of Oregon in the business of getting people to work. And so often the private agency is made the butt of all kinds of situations which we become involved in because of the very sensitive area which we occupy at the heart of, for instance, the problems of discrimination, of fair trade practices, of many laws which are on the books, which we as agencies actively support every single day with every word that a counselor says over the telephone to a client. We are supporting the Civil Rights Act of 64, all these other things which are consumer protection. So that what I'm saying is that we think that the emphasis very often is wrong, that in the public interest, the employment agencies are doing a very important service, and they should be looked upon as a resource that can be used to accomplish the State of Oregon's manpower objective. One of the ways this could be done in the CETA program is, I think, to use private employment agencies on a contract for service base. I happen to be working in Portland once a week on a panel of which I am chairman, examining the budget for the Public Safety Department in the city of Portland. And last night we had a presentation from Patrick Berunder of the Human Resources Department. It's related to the CETA program, so I happen to get just a little bit of insight into it. I asked him, for instance, what is the cost of a unit that is processed through the CETA program in his prime contract area? And the answer was something like between $4,000 and $5,000 per unit. If you stack this sort of thing up against the fee that a person would have to pay an agency, whether it's $300 or $400, it begins to look less onerous. And also in relation to the contract for service question, he answered that they had contracted for a placement with the U.S. Employment Service, that to his knowledge there was no reason why they could not also contract with private employment agencies to do the job. Have any questions of the president?
You're speaking of contract for service. You mean that, like Wayne Community College would contract for your service, or the CETA fund, CETA people contract for
service? Mr. Chairman, I was thinking of the CETA program, actually, contract for service. And this is something, not only CETA, but as you well know, there's a whole mess of manpower programs of all kinds. And so that somehow or other, the private employment agencies become completely overlooked. Contracts for services, that is a thing that happens everywhere throughout the whole fabric of our economy. And in Portland, for instance, it's Commissioner Jordan's idea that wherever they can, they want to contract for service rather than build up their own bureaucracy. And this is a policy that I would go along with, too. So that we do have an existence, a private process, which it simply hasn't been exploited for the benefit of the public and shouldn't be overlooked. I'd like to make that point for ourselves and for the association. CETA might be one, but it might be some other programs too that could use it to advantage.
Other questions?
I didn't quite get your connection with this. Are you an association officer and private employee?
We have an association known as the Oregon Association of Employment Services Incorporated. It's a non-profit organization.
It's a
trade organization. It's the only one in actually in existence that's active now. The successor to what used to be the Oregon Placement Association 2 years ago.
Would a reputable, ethical private employment agency have specific contact people within an employee organization that they would make contact with?
Ordinarily, with a particular person in a particular organization?
Yes.
I would think that very quickly, after an initial contact had been made, that it would boil down to that, because you wouldn't want to start off with somebody new every time.
So, if someone from one of these agencies, from an agency, call to an organization such as Wayne Community College, and whoever happens to answer the phone, they ask them if they have any job open, would that really be proper?
Well, I think, as this Tiger Secker said, the person would be, I'm not sure I can answer your question whether it's proper, but the way the industry works is that if you have an applicant come in, what you are doing is setting yourself up as the advocate for the individual to try to find him or her a job. This must not be lost sight of. I think one of the most important functions we perform is that we try to develop an appreciation of what the individual has to offer in relation to the work area. And making this appraisal, we then spend a lot of time casting around and trying to find out where we can develop a job for that person. And in doing that, we naturally would first go to people whom we already have done business with, but beyond that, we would open up new contacts with companies anywhere who, if the counselor gets an idea, if he or she is creative enough, they'll finally find something where maybe somebody will create a job for this person because they have peculiar skills and capabilities which they haven't been able to find elsewhere.
I don't believe you answered the question.
Sorry.
My question was, would it be proper for someone in a private employment service to call an organization like LPC, and whomever answered the telephone asked that individual if there was a job open?
No, I don't think you would just speak to whoever answered the phone.
No. You named an individual who apparently placed his job working.
Yes.
Now, my understanding is this person is expected to work here.
I'm sorry, I thought she was, I don't know what her position was. I think she was in the personnel department, whether she was an interviewer, a counselor, or what. I'm sorry, I don't know.
I would say that I think maybe getting to your question is, if I were the counselor making the call, I would want to be sure that the person who gave me the job order had the authority to do so. Is that answer your question?
No. What happens if one of these placements is made on the basis of a job order placed by someone who did not have the authority to place the job order?
Then somebody's in trouble.
I got the job. Might be. They always seem to be complimentary. Now, I've dealt quite a long period of time with private employment services, and I noticed there's quite a difference between their operations. Some would send me a person who had a card, an introduction card. I made comments on this card, and I mailed it back to the employment service, which I think is a good way to handle it. However, there are others who do not follow that kind of procedure. In this particular case, LPC was that kind of a procedure followed.
We don't know. We're really not directly involved. And she's only, my wife was trying to establish some of the facts by telephone, I think. And so we're a little bit out on a limb if we try to get down to the details of it.
One more question. It would appear to me that there's possibly a combination of problems with this specific case. And that combination can always come together again. Perhaps there was some negligence on the part of the person who called to inquire about the job, and there was negligence of the internal operation within Plain Community College. We're going to deal with a law that's going to affect everyone. Do you have any kind of suggestion that would provide protection for the person who might be using the service?
I think the idea of the letter is a very good one. If it comes, I would hope that you would allow the prior employment agency to be a part of the person's case. And in the event that it does, and if the employer has exhausted the primary sources to which he's required to go in a prescribed time, and then it is open, if a letter could be written saying what the job description is, it's part of the CETA program, this is your role in it, then there is no question. There's been a lack of communication here, and I think a lack of
I find it difficult to believe that anyone would have to go through a private employment agency for one of these positions. So in my district, on those openings that came about, people were lined up at the beginning of the hour for application.
I find it hard to believe, I may comment, that someone who is eligible for a CETA program job would also be able to have a credit card that they could use for, to pay to pay the bill. Are there any questions?
You believe the oral orders is a good idea. I'm looking here at maybe there is a problem in this acceptance agreement in this one particular case we're talking about, whereby, not casually, as you so will explain, but that, in other words, that there could be a breakdown in this communication by telephone where someone would assume that Lane or anybody else, any other, had actually placed an order.
I would think that the agency would be required to show that it did have an order, and then if that agency's procedures had some holes in it, they could be locked down pretty quickly by the Bureau of Labor, which has the important to do of the statute governing employment agencies. I think the system is there, and it may be that when the details are examined, it may be that there is or is not fault about the agency. I wouldn't be prepared to say. But I think that we've got a very good system. It's been in operation for almost 2 years, and the agency should be able to substantiate that it did have a bona fide job order.
Now, I can't imagine myself, and I'm sure not expert. I don't have any expertise in dairy, but you're being in it to answer the question. I think I don't see where these applications for jobs or placements with your organization or other like organizations is something that would have to be done at within that day. In other words, picking up the phone and placing the order by phone, or you calling the agency. And in other words, the time element, could not the same thing be accomplished in writing and not be a hindrance to you or the other party?
I'd like to respond to that because the time element is absolutely essential in a situation like this. And I'd like to make an analogy here between, let's say, the employment of a person who has a job opening for which there may be contention among half a dozen or 50 people. And the first guy that gets there has the first appointment, so I was the one who might get the job. For 19 years, I was a stockbroker with Merrill Lynch. And as such, I made many, many contracts over the telephone by word of mouth for the purchase of many tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of securities. So I don't think that in this modern day that we could operate without the help of the telephone. It would be to the detriment of the individual with all of that.
In receiving these orders over the phone?
These orders over the phone. See, it's essential, wouldn't you agree with that?
I would in the normal course. I was thinking of this particular program where it is under very definite prescribed rules and regs, that maybe a written job order would be to our benefit.
That was
as
going
well.
To be my next question.
Yeah.
What about programs like this?
Because you would assume that you have to go through certain public channels first. And so the time element isn't discussing is a red hot order. It's open to everybody.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Lance?
Chairman, I'm Ron Land from the Executive Department. The CETA program responsibilities generally lie under Stafford Hansel now. As an assistant to him, I exercise general coordination of the program in the prime sponsor area of the governor's, which is 29 counties of Oregon. The other counties receive money in the other prime sponsor areas directly from the Department of Labor. These other counties include Lane, Multnomah, Washington, Clackamas, the consortium of Marion, Polk, and Yamhill, and City of Portland. In these particular areas, the actual procedures differ in a slight degree because different areas have different unemployment problems, so they're just a little bit different than all of these. Some of the questions that have been asked previously here about, particularly about the rules and regulations of who can be hired and so on, there are some general, very well-defined rules. 30% of the individuals can be professional type, with the exception of classroom teachers, of which there is no limit. A little hooker.
Could I ask a question right now, Mr. Chairman?
Go right ahead.
You mean there's no limit on the amount of CETA funds that can be spent to hire classroom teachers? Is that
there? There are no limit on the number of jobs in that particular category specified as classroom teachers.
But they have to fall within 30%?
No, they're out of the 30%.
100% of the money go for classroom teachers?
Theoretically, could.
Theoretically.
Yes. Although there are people prioritizing these jobs that will never happen.
Yeah, well, I understand that. But okay. Thank you.
Generally, there are some other guidelines. As the $10,000 is the limit that can be paid under CETA. There are also some other guidelines which are informally followed. About a $7,800 average is what we try to achieve per year under CETA jobs. There are target groups under the CETA program, which the most seriously disadvantaged people are to be given prime consideration. These are those that have exhausted their unemployment benefits, those that are not eligible for employment, those who are seriously disadvantaged, welfare recipients, people who are ethnic minorities, Vietnam-era veterans. Various categories of people who are the most seriously disadvantaged are target groups in the program. CETA, I don't know how deep to go into CETA. It's a very complicated program. CETA is made up of many, many titles, which even though all of us who work in it every day get a little confused in sometimes. Title I of CETA generally provides on-the-job training kind of funds. Title II was the earlier version of CETA, which provided public service jobs. Now the difference, and then later Title VI has just emerged. The difference, generally speaking, in Title II and Title VI is that Title II funds put more stress upon transitional employment. In other words, trying to get the person into a job situation where he eventually would be absorbed into an agency as an employee. Title VI relaxes these criteria to some degree and says really we're in a situation where we need immediate employment. The time compression under VI has been squeezed down to where the federal government is now saying whatever you have to do, get the people on in a very short time. So there has been a little bit of a shift in emphasis under from VI to II.
Is this, Mr. Chairman, more transitory?
Six is less transitory than two. Six, we are saying that the immediate push is to get as many people employed now as we can.
You're not trying to work them into a permanent slot.
It's a general goal, but it's not a requirement.
Yeah.
As in all these programs, we use very weird wording sometimes. Goals, targets, and efforts, and all attempts and this sort of thing. Title VI has been modified to some degree to, well, Title II and VI, to Senate Bill 51 and 52, generally which takes all CETA jobs from it and removed them from the classified service and placed them in unclassified service. This allows a little more speed in hiring. The other aspect of this is that from a budgetary control standpoint, Senate Bill 52, they removed the agency from limitation and increased requirements.
Question? One of the criticisms I've heard of CETA employment from the local units of government, and I'm curious to hear, that once CETA funds are terminated and the employee is then terminated, then the push is put on to create the position of full-time equivalency and being paid out of local funds. The pressure upon the budget, so to speak. Have you heard this?
I've heard it discussed several times. And okay. I've seen some national articles on the same subject in which this seems to be some threat, and it really creates a problem at the local level. To what extent, you know, these jobs are going to. The question has been brought up many times. If a job is put on that doesn't exist now in a locality, does it mean they shift from getting along without something to permanently having something, and then the budget pressures and so on? I just can't answer that sort of question.
I know I've seen it myself, and the individual then becomes part of the team, and suddenly he's severed, and then the big rush is to find a way to get him to stay on the team.
I don't know how much of a briefing you really want as far as the details of the program, but I'd better stop and answer questions if you have any.
Any questions now?
Yeah, I got a bunch.
A whole bunch?
Sorry. Seven.
Sorry.
They're short, though. This is just to educate on the requirements of CETA and so on. I understand from previous testimony that the maximum amount of money available for a person under the CETA program is $10,000.
Per year.
Per year, okay.
Plus the other fringe benefits.
Okay. Now, how long do the funds... Are the funds available?
CETA 2 funds are scheduled at this time to expire around June 30th. We've also been notified by Region 10 that they will probably extend into maybe September or so, and maybe even refund it again. It's unlikely.
But that would take further legislative action by Congress to do that.
Yeah. As you know, there are many bills in Congress, even ranging up to the addition of a million more public service employees.
Yeah.
Title 6 funds at the present time were, well, I think it's January the 31st when this particular allocation expired. But there's every evidence these will be renewed.
Okay. Now, as far as being eligible for hiring under the CETA program. Previous testimony also indicated you had to be unemployed for 30 days.
Well, generally, in the balance of the state, 29 counties under the governor's jurisdiction, this has been waived now under high unemployment for 15 days. You must be unemployed for 15 days.
Well, now, what about those counties that were exempt from the grip of the executive?
I'm not really sure about all. Lane County is still 30 days.
Wouldn't be over 30 days, eh?
No, 30 days.
That's close enough. I don't want to belabor this thing. No restriction on the reason why you're unemployed. Facts are you just haven't got a job.
True.
Okay. No restrictions on household income or anything else. Follows along with other unemployment programs. Makes no difference if your spouse is making $100,000 a year.
I understand.
Yeah,
that's true.
Okay, very good. How much money comes into the state of Oregon under the CETA program?
$34 million, I think, under this program includes so many things, certain aspects of vocational rehab, Title I, Title III, which is migrant program. What we've received under, generally speaking, what we've received under the state share portion. Around $4.5 million, I think, for Title II, and it's about the same for Title VI at this time. I should have brought those sheets, but I don't have
4.5, 9.
Just a public service type program in the balance of the state, which is the ones that we're primary. Now that in addition, each county, these other counties that are prime sponsors get certain allocations of
Chuck, do we have?
Well, you bring them back or what is that?
Yeah, we could get the breakdowns on all this. I just don't have all
okay, that. Okay, 30 to 40 million isn't far off, though.
No, 30 million.
Now, which title is it that provides the public service type job?
I'm assuming Title II and Title VI.
Okay. Now, a college professor, an example of a college instructor, it would be a public service job. Under Title II?
This would be a public service job. It would not be, it would be one that would be administered at the county level. What happens is the funds that are received in the balance of the state, about 80% of these funds are passed out to the county or to a district to use for these local jobs. These can be jobs in cities, counties, and various elements of localities. About 20% of the funds then are used for state employees or in state agencies.
The executive department, has the executive department got anything to say about how the county spend any of that money they dole out?
Well, under the, as you know, the whole ball of wax is being reorganized right now. The manpower planning people, who are the general overlords of the funds, they have been moved to the executive department very recently by executive order. There are some checks and balances on this and the fact that they do receive the prioritized list from the county, but normally it's the local people who establish these priorities.
The local committee establishes,
yes.
Right, I understand that procedure. Now, in those seven counties, there are seven counties that are exempt from the clutches of the executive department, is that right? Okay, but they're free to do it on their own.
Yes.
They administer their own funds. It comes straight to the Fed, to them?
Yes. There is some coordination between
okay,
them.
Okay, coordination,
the,
yes.
But generally speaking, they have the ball. And they have freedom to, well, within guidelines.
Yeah. Well, within the federal guidelines.
Yes.
That ends my question.
Representative Pratt?
You hit them all of mine.
They were already answered, huh?
I'd ask your feelings on the use of the funds that an employee hired on a student program would receive, if they should be used, in your estimation, for to pay the fees for to a private employment agency.
The best information we can find out, there is no particular rule that prohibits the use of a private employment agency for the unclassified service people. It's my belief that most of the jobs, and those that I've had the most familiarity with, state jobs, really, that we prioritize, there would be very little, there would be very few times when I can see that it would be necessary for them to go to a private. Many of the jobs which we are trying to create crew type activities, highway maintenance, forestry people, and that sort of thing, I have a tendency to believe that the unemployment situation is so great that there are people waiting for all but a few, maybe of the very professional type jobs. I also feel because the target group that we're aiming at is the most seriously disadvantaged in the population, and it seems to me somewhat, I almost want to use the word unfair, to have them pay high fees to secure a job.
When you have the employment division,
when we have it in force now, and they can't, I think they, so far, they've been able revised enough applicants, except there are some geography questions involved in this program. As you know, the funds are actually allocated to each county, which means that a remote county, if there were some state jobs out in these remote counties that we could not conveniently fill, there have been times when we've had to actually cancel a job because they're just not applicants out there. There are some real problems in the geographic constraints of how these funds are distributed and how you're able to locate people. But from a normal standpoint, particularly under Title VI, we've had pretty good luck in filling these jobs.
There's somebody here from the
employment
division. Yes, sir. Yeah. Thank you. Mr. Sisma? I'm Leonard Sisma, and I'm chief of the employment service in the employment division. And there are a couple of things I think that more than a couple have become very confusing about this. But first of all, under Title II and Title VI of the Act, the Employment Division has some program operating responsibility in the balance of states with the governor. We do not have any program operating responsibility in any of the prime sponsor areas outside of the balance of state prime sponsor areas of Title II and Title VI. These are the two titles, as Mr. Land said, under which public service employment jobs are created. Now, that operating responsibility in the balance of state has to do with contracting with the user agencies and so on and so forth. Quite aside from that, though, is this question of placement and referral. It really has nothing to do with that program operation responsibility. We're simply receive an order from an employer. In this case, it happens to be one who has the job created from public service employment funds, and then we make referrals to that employer. We have no contract for making those referrals. We get no seat of funds for making those referrals. And there's no, none of the seat of money is put into that activity. Position is that we are a public employment service, and this is a job order, and we make a referral to that employer, public employer in this case, and they select from these individuals the ones that we'll hire. In Lane County, just to give you some idea of the volume we're talking about, incidentally, there is a provision in the federal regulations that all of these public service employment jobs have to be placed with the state employment service for 48 hours before anyone else can be hired. But it does not specify that the individual hired has to come from. Simply that the order has to be placed with for 48 hours. And that was primarily to assure that veterans would have an opportunity for referral. And we're required by our laws to give preference in referral to all jobs to veterans. And as a consequence, by placing the order with us for 48 hours, the intent was that veterans would get preference for referral to these jobs. But there is no requirement that the individual hired come from our office. Simply that the order has to be there 48 hours before someone not referred by us could be hired. Under Title II in Lane County, and I hasten to add in Lane County that we have no program operation responsibility. Lane County has that. The jobs that Lane Community College have under CETA are administered by Lane County. Not us. We have no program responsibility at all. They are, however, placing with us these job orders in compliance with the employers, the public service employers are. We received under Title II 47 job openings, notice of them. We made 115 referrals under Title VI, we had 188 job openings placed with it, and we made 779 referrals.
Okay. Could we get those figures?
Sure.
Sure. They're just, I don't want to stretch you there, sir.
We can get them off anywhere they have authority in the state, if you'd like.
Sure.
I would like to
speak to them. Yeah,
that's
easy.
Now, in some cases, the job orders are not that readily identified in Wayne County because of the particular arrangement they have. But it is possible for us not to know that a job order is a seated job. Employer calls us and gives us certain requirements. The responsibility for determining that the individual finally hired on that job meets the requirements of the state law is up to the employer who is receiving the money to hire. That employer has a contract with the operating agency, whoever it might be, and they are accountable on that contract for assuring that the people they hire do meet the eligibility requirements under the law, and they will probably be monitored by whoever that program operator or prime sponsor is with regard to their compliance with that law. So they could possibly call us and say, I need an individual, and not tell us it was a CEO. In Lane County, and I can't discuss this in any detail because, again, we're not directly involved in the state program, but my understanding is Lane County has determined that they will, their manpower operation, that they will make this certification on all individuals hired. They want to do it. So we happen to know in the referral process here, who is. Now, there was a comment earlier about contracts with the Employment Service. We have contracts with what was the Department of Human Resources, now will be with the Executive Department, to do some administrative activities in the balance of state where the governor is the prime sponsor. In some of the other prime sponsors, and that's under Title II and VI, we also have a contract to perform some program operational functions with regard to Title I, which is training, work experience, on-the-job training, and so on and so forth. In some of the prime sponsor areas, and this is true in the city of Portland, we have a small contract with the city of Portland to do job development and placement on behalf of individuals served under Title I of CEDA, which is a training and job development, or training and related kinds of activities, on-the-job training, work experience, and so forth. We do not have any contract money coming to us for the placement of individuals into public service employment where the city of Portland has made these jobs available to public agencies. That's not a contractual arrangement. They just place an order with it. And we do the things that we operate a public employment service to do, make referrals to them. I'd be happy to answer any other questions you might have.
Whatever questions you're going to ask, you're going to have to ask them fast. In 5 minutes, we have to leave.
True, I'm going to take a minute total.
Go ahead.
Do you know of any other organization in the state of Oregon that employs 40 people on the CEDA program?
Any other public employer who has...
Public employer, yeah, you could, but, excluding, say, the state of Oregon, per se, I'm talking about...
There are probably some larger state agencies that have close to that, without digging into it.
30 to 40 employees on the CEDA program in one location, one institution.
In one particular location?
Pretty high, isn't it?
Well, I really can't answer whether it's high or not. I don't know about the state form. I don't know of any, to answer your question directly, I know of no other organization that on one particular geographic site is employing 30 or 40 people.
Okay, now my last question, and if you consider it leading, you probably can't give me the answer. Maybe I'll direct it to the chairman. I'd be extremely interested in knowing the names of the members of the committee in Lane County who are making the decisions. Do you have that available in your office?
I don't have it available in my office, and it depends on what kind of decisions. But I would suggest that probably in discussion with Mr. Land and his staff, that they would have the information as to the makeup of the committee in that kind.
We can get it.
I don't care.
I want to do it without casting any stones. I just,
you know,
it's an example of. No, I'm not going to editorial like this.
Representative Press.
Okay, quickly. Cannot employment, the employment division handle all placements for CETA funded positions?
Well, with the answer to your question, you know, in a general term, certainly.
Okay.
Now, there can be an isolated kind of a situation if somebody decides that they want an atomic. Physicists or something like this, I don't know how they do 10,000, it'd be ridiculous, but you know, there are particular, but in general, the answer to your question is yes, we can.
Is the employment division getting any CETA funded positions?
Yes, we are. We're getting some CETA funded positions under the contract that I've talked to you about. We're also getting some public service employment positions, as are the state agencies.
Now, this has popped up in several of the testimonies that I've heard previously. My next question is. What would be the argument against making known immediately that the position be filled with a CETA-funded position?
Well, there's no. You mean as far as the employer who's placing
right.
the order?
Either way,
there's no problem as far as we're concerned. There's certainly no reason not to.
The reason I ask that is it seems that this isn't the case all the time. By one party or the other, that it's they're not saying it's a CETA position.
Well, I guess, you know, I don't want to get in the wrong question you, but what if an applicant is looking for a job and they're put on into the Army employer's payroll and so forth, what significance to the applicant that it's a CETA funded position?
I don't think there is. If there is to the applicant.
Okay. So then you're saying, is there a problem with the employer, why shouldn't they identify as a CETA funded position? And there's no particular reason they shouldn't. What we certainly would require is that they give us all of the information about what their hiring requirements are that they can possibly give us.
The next one, and I think you said, Portland does use the employment division to fill their CETA position.
Well, the City of Portland would, under their Title II, Title VI public service employment contract with. Contract with some agency. It could be a state agency, it could be a county agency, so on. Now, that agency then is required to place their order with us for 48 hours before they do any other hiring. And the orders are coming in all areas of the state, and we are sending people out. I use the Lane County figures as an example only because that was where the question arose.
Right. Okay, my arguments are pro or con against him, private or.
Yes.
Whatever. I have used both many years ago personally, and I found that even at that time, and I don't know what the situation is, better or worse now, but the employment division did a terrific job. And
thank you.
They had so many resources there, and it didn't cost me or the employer, to my knowledge, anything for the service.
Well, in a sense, the employers are already paying for this service because we are funded from part of the tax that pays the federal government on the payroll.
Right.
But we do not charge a fee.
Right.
At the time.
Thank you. Thank you.
Is that it? Thank you very much. We'll recess at 1:30. House Labor Committee now come to order, and we'll start with House Bill 2284. Representative Katz, you can go through the whole bit, though. You don't have to stay with one bill.
Because some of the people who I've introduced on Steve's behalf, I've introduced to them and not here. And so why don't I go through and make it happen? Chairman, members of the committee, I have several bills that have my name as sponsors in front of you this afternoon. Most of the bills, except House Bill 2284, was at the request of different organizations, and I'll explain it as we get to the bill. House Bill 2284 is really very simple, and I'm not sure, after conferring with Mr. John Meyer, your administrative aide, whether legislative counsel has done this bill some justice, and we already recommended some modification. But the principle is really very simple, and it's one that you probably discussed when you were discussing unit pricing. It would not allow a merchant from selling consumer commodities, food commodities, at a higher price per ounce than a price per ounce of the same consumer commodity of same brand in smaller quantities. In other words, if you have a 2 ounce can and a 16 ounce can per price, that large size cannot cost more per ounce than the smaller one. Now, the sheet in front of you is a report from one of my interns who went out on February 16th and 19th to several stores to check the price per ounce on the small size Tide laundry detergent, Carnation and Xenon fat, and the other products, up through the large size, and computed the price per ounce. And as you see, the consumer who usually knows that the economy size or the larger size is cheaper than the small size is really getting fooled in some of these stores. On the bottom of this sheet, there is reference to an Oxford study that will be coming out on Monday, and that's why I don't have the data for this committee this afternoon. The survey was completed of stores, and they found that 5% of the survey items cost more per unit in the large size containers than in the small size containers. And that's all the bill would do, would prohibit that from happening. Now, for those of you who were here last session, when the unit pricing bill hit the floor of the House, Representative Martin stood up and said, well, why don't we just do this? And that was fine with me, except we had a different bill on the floor. And so I had invited Representative Martin, I guess he's not here, to come and share this testimony with me, because I know he will support the concept, since he did support it on the floor of the House. That's all on that piece of legislation.
Transport, but
sure.
I'm sure, Vera, that you've had this argument thrown at you already. If you're packaging a small amount of material and a larger amount of material, it may cost you more to package a number of small items in contrast to one large. Have you heard that argument?
It costs you more for the smaller one.
Yeah, it costs you more to package a number of small
ones. That's right. But the argument is, why should that larger one cost more per ounce than the smaller one? In other words, the price should be going down rather than up. And this sheet shows that in some items the price is going the other way. So when it's a super economy size, the consumer is in fact being fooled. And most of the consumers, men and women, can't compute that quickly at the grocery store. And I dare any of you to do it.
Well, make that smaller quantity.
Yeah. Do we have industry testimony on this bill?
Sure do.
Okay. Thank you.
What? Oh, a question. Well, I think it would be better to ask a question of the bill.
Okay, I just would ask you that on some of these where I don't have the technical knowledge,
yeah,
there are people.
That isn't referred to this bill. You think a company, for example, doesn't have an exclusion or exemption. Let's say they have a product, new product. Why try to get people to try it? People don't want to buy a big size. Understand what I mean? So then they decrease the price per unit of a small size to get people to try it. And then, and so if you were to go into the store and sample, you'd say, well, this one is more expensive for the big one,
example, a small one, when in effect it's kind of a marketing strategy to get market penetration to
okay.
bring a new product on the market.
Representative Wolfer, in Section 3, Subsection 2, and John, that may answer that may be the reason that's in there. That may solve that.
That may be, you know what I'm saying, though, it's like when Procter & Gamble or someone is bringing a new product on the market, for example, it's not like 14 days. I mean, you're talking, what I'm saying is market penetration, that may last 6 months or a year to try to achieve that. Because, you know, you can't 14 days saturate a market the size of Oregon or even the size of Portland with a product, or even saturate with a product, but I mean to get the consumer to be willing to try it. You know, the news is known as a campaign. You know, the public's out there, and they've got so many other things going on around them that to get them to try, you know, like for example, in a campaign, to be interested in X candidate, it takes a lot of things over a period of time to even for them to know who it is.
You're talking. I'm not sure. I did work in a market research firm, and we did do product testing, and I'm not sure that we penetrated the market for a period of 6 months.
Well, all I'm saying is that some of these large companies have a very long period type of thing when they aren't really even concerned about whether they're making money or not on the product. They're trying to get market share.
You may want to. Yeah, I understand what you're saying.
And I'm just saying is that going to be in the way of...
If section 3, subsection 2, responds to that concern, that will take care of it. You could take a look at changing the 14 consecutive days, but that would leave that to your legislative administration assistant, your AA here. We can say legislative council, but they just didn't do the job on this, so leave it.
Okay.
The concept, of course, is to stop fooling the consumer by calling it a
kind
of
right.
Okay. Yes, I think that'll solve it.
Mr. Chairman, in Section 3, subsection 1, beginning on 921, I think, I know what that says, but I think it says if the retailer had to pay the same amount per ounce or had to pay more per ounce for the large size, then that product is exempt. Is that what this says?
If that's what it says, then that's fine, but I'm not sure, and that's what I was
that's
talking with John. I wasn't
that's
sure
what
that's
read,
what it says.
How do you, may I ask
you? Put it this way, are you willing to eliminate Section 3?
Yeah, he's got a legitimate concern on that.
Well,
if that's a real problem.
But in a campaign, a new brand of soap, you want them during the promotional period of whatever it is to be able to sell the larger packages at more per ounce than the little ones? What difference does it make? Does it make any difference to you whether it's in a promotional campaign or not? If you're still paying more per ounce in the larger package than you are in the smaller packages, you're getting the shaft. I mean, that's according to what you're trying to do here. So, I don't really see where, unless I'm wrong, I don't see where Section 3 adds anything.
Yeah, that's a policy question that you asked me on promotional products.
But isn't it what you don't want to do? You don't want anybody to violate Section 2.
That's right.
Period. So what does Section 3 add anything?
No, I understand what you're saying. Yes. May
Mr.
I go on,
Roger?
Mr.
Chair?
Oh.
You have a question you want to ask?
Yeah, I've got a question. I may forget it. A little too far here. Do you have knowledge of any product costing the retailer more per ounce in the larger size than in the smaller size?
No, we did not take a look at the wholesale price book to make that determination. Maybe there is that kind of information, and we can maybe probably go back and check to see whether that in fact was the case on these items. And maybe the Oxford report. May I ask, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, may I ask one of my interns who went back?
Sure.
If he has that information.
Sure.
Do you want to respond to that question, whether the wholesale price of those items or whether you know the wholesale?
Okay. We may go back. It's possible, but I can't see how, because usually in packaging, It is less expensive, but there may be exceptions. Yes. And if there are exceptions, then if you interpret that one correctly, again, you may have to change the language on that. And I can't answer that as clearly as now as I probably would like to.
Another problem or question I have, I guess, is, you know, a number of stores such as Safeway, when a price comes in at a lower price, they'll mark it down, but when it goes up, they won't mark it up. Smaller items move faster and will be replaced faster than large items. If I get into a situation, do you mean for it to apply? I think you see what you're saying.
I've been thinking about it, and I agree that the purpose of this bill is answered in Section 2, and really, under no circumstances should the consumer be fooled that on the larger contract. Mr. Chairman, I have to chair another committee.
Unless there's something really pertaining that somebody else can't answer, let's let Vera get on to
okay.
Two, because otherwise.
Now, House Bill 2301 was at the request of Dr. Olson, who I understand will be here at 2:30 or 3 o'clock, and it would require individual and group health policies to cover family members and provide coverage for a newborn child from the moment of birth. I received a letter from Comprehensive Health Planning and Dr. Olson requesting that a bill be introduced in the Oregon legislature that would mandate that health insurance coverage. I did a little research and found the model bill. This bill is drawn on the model bill. The model bill that's used across the country has been drawn up jointly by the American Academy of Pediatrics and the Health Insurance Associations of America. Most of the bills and most of the insurance coverage the policies exclude newborns from coverage and don't go into effect until about 14 days after the child is born. In the Oregonian article that probably most of you have seen, the coverage did not go into effect after 90 days. The cost to families and in turn to the hospitals, because many times the hospitals have to write it off as a loss, is considerable. In one of the articles that I read in St. Louis Children's Hospital, the cost is about $100,000 a year for the hospital, and they write it off as free care. I received a letter from Cascade, which is an HMO in Portland, and they were very supportive of this particular legislation, and had attached to this letter, and I will leave it with you, the bills for a preemie, premature child that eventually was adopted for 1 month. Oh, Mr. Stewart is here, and he'll probably discuss that. He is executive director of Cascade. And the cost for 1 month was $2,000. Emmanuel Hospital, I understand, had a child for 89 days. The family's coverage started on the 90th day. The bill for the family was $10,000. And this bill is in effect in 24 states. It is suggested by the sponsors of the bill that it would cost no more than 25 cents a month per family, a little higher per individual. As a mother, you don't usually expect a disaster when you're carrying your child. Consequently, you don't think of even taking a look at the coverage or even assume that something's going to go wrong. But when it does and you don't have that coverage, you're either bankrupt or you don't pay the bill. And that's the reason for House Bill 2301. The technical questions, I'm sure, can be answered by the physicians and health service people, and of course the insurance companies that have an interest. I also have a letter from Dr. Victor Manassi, Assistant Dean and Director of the University of Oregon Health Science Center, very pleased that this bill was introduced. Mm-hmm. As many of you know, that there is a neonatal section up at the hospital. The University of Oregon Health Science Center is doing some very exciting work with premature children, children that are not normal, and it's costing that particular crippled children's division up in the hospital a lot of money because there are just no funds covering some of those emergencies. House Bill 2388, and I will address House Bill 2388 since I prefer that over House Bill 2330.
What's the bill number, sir?
2388 is a bill that was sponsored by me at the request of the Regional Alcoholism Board in the Tri-County area, which is a planning arm in the area of alcoholism, planning arm to comprehensive health planning. And they're very concerned about the fact that we don't have health coverage, mandatory health coverage, and group health coverage and group policies covering alcoholism. We have recognized that alcoholism is a disease and deserves as much attention as any other disease does. In fact, it's probably the number one public health problem in this country. Most people who have insurance policies are not covered for alcoholism. When they are very ill, they go to the hospital sometimes under other pretenses. The cost for hospital care is high, and it's foolish to have insurance companies paying those high costs when that kind of treatment can be given in residential facilities and outpatient facilities at a far cheaper rate. This particular bill deals with group health policies benefits only, and when group health policies are made available, benefits for treatment of alcoholism therefore should be included. It is an old bill. It's been around Senate Bill 509 last session and a couple of Senate bills prior to that.
Well, tell us that for you.
Well, you're going to hear from the insurance industry on this one, and this is an old battle on any mandatory coverage. You're going to hear from the insurance industry that it's going to cost more, and why should we force that kind of coverage on everybody when people should be a little more careful when they buy insurance policies to cover what they want to cover. Washington has adopted this bill as of July 1974. I know of two states, Minnesota and Wisconsin, that also have legislation such as this, and if I'm not mistaken, the Oregon State Employees Association has coverage for alcoholism under their group health plan. Blue Cross of Maryland, interestingly enough, had coverage for hospital care only, and now have extended that coverage for residential facilities at the cost of $43.43 per month per person. I think you need to examine how third-party coverage would stimulate employers' willingness to identify employee alcohol problems, and then insist that that kind of treatment be taking place in their particular place of business, rather than ignoring the problem because there is no coverage at all. And one of the places that we can tax problems of alcoholism is where people work. And it's been a great concern to many big employers in this state, and many of them have a very high rate of alcoholism. At least the employees have a high rate of alcoholism, and it's costing the employers a lot of money. If this kind of coverage was mandated in group health, perhaps there would be some saving, or at least perhaps we'd be treating some people. Now, the final ones, of course, are the ones that you've all been waiting for. House Bill 2272 and 2276. And I'm not going to dwell very long on this, but I do want to give you some kind of historic background. Most of you who sit on the interim committee have already heard it.
True.
My concern is, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that during the last session, we passed House Bill 2116. It is now, I think, ORS 3675, or at least that particular chapter. In House Bill 2116, we said that the state, that you can no longer in the state of Oregon discriminate on the basis of sex or marital status in housing, employment, and public accommodation. And redefine public accommodation to include any place or service offering the public accommodation advantages, facilities, or privileges, whether in the nature of goods, services, and the key word here is services, lodgings, amusements, or otherwise. And we found after the bill was passed and signed by the governor that in fact in the insurance industry there was still discrimination based on sex or marital status. And we defined services that we saw insurance falling under service. I can't give you the exact date, but pressure was put on Commissioner Rawls in the insurance division, and he did come out with some rules. Have any of you received a copy of these rules? Maybe you want to make copies of that, and I'll leave it with you. That would make it illegal to have policies that make a distinction based on sex or marital status in the following manner. The availability of an insurance policy. Some policies in the past were not available to women, or to divorced women, or to single women, or perhaps even to married women, or men. Two, the availability of a particular amount of insurance or set of coverage, delimiting factors. Sometimes you couldn't get a certain insurance policy at a certain rate. They were different, or they were not available. Three, and here's the problem. The availability of a particular policy coverage or type of benefit, except for those relating to physical characteristics unique to one sex. And the one that the insurance industry, the insurance commissioner was referring to was maternity, that was having a child was unique to one sex. And consequently, they could discriminate against the policy. Yes.
About what?
Yes. But I could also give you another. I could give you some examples. And I don't have time of certain operations that are unique to the other sex that we can't you know enjoy.
Enjoy.
the premium for a particular policy unless demonstrated based on reasonable supporting data. And the problem here is, of course, that we have actuarial tables that show that a woman lives much longer than a male, and because the actuarial tables show that, they can discriminate on the premium rate based on sex, and at this time there is an advantage to the woman. Now the question, of course, is of jurisdiction. Who was covered under House Bill 2116 and who was not? We maintain the insurance industry is. The insurance commissioner maintains he's covered under another chapter in the ORS, ORS 746015. And so we have a question of jurisdiction, and we are not quite sure at this point who in fact deals with policies of sex discrimination in insurance matters. Now, one of the arguments was that we proposed to the insurance division was, well, we know that blacks' life expectancy is much shorter. You used to discriminate based on race. You no longer discriminate based on race. And the response is, yes, that's right. We know through actuarial tables that black life expectancy seems much shorter, but that is socially unacceptable to discriminate based on race. Well, we maintain that it's just as socially unacceptable to now to discriminate based on sex and marital status, and we show our statutes to prove it. We maintain also that there are other variables that you could plug into the actuarial table, and that it's about time the insurance industry was shaken up a little bit, and that they start plugging in men and women at work and take a look at the educational background and the economic status, not only sex, when they're looking at life expectancy. Now, if you feel that you cannot act on this, and this may become a legal battle, then perhaps you ought to take a look during the interim at a whole review of our insurance policies and force the insurance division to justify really any true rate differential. We don't have an actuarial at this time. I think Ways and Means plug in some money for the insurance division to have an actuarial so that there'll be somebody taking a look at workers' compensation rates and also sex and marital status rates. Mr. Chairman, I would love to say, but I have an anxious committee that's trying to set some policies and community policies, and they're waiting for me downstairs. As I say, I introduced these bills at the request of some other groups. I assume they are not sitting in the audience and would be more than happy to testify and answer any technical questions.
We know where to get you if we want.
Fine. Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I would like to extend my services and the services of my interns for the purpose of...
What are you blushing for?
Now, for the purpose of trying to clean up the language in our that little unit pricing bill. And thank you.
Okay, thanks. Let's see. Is that up then to the first bill?
2284.
Correct. Then we have Gail do it for you?
Probably do better.
Okay, we'll go back to 2284. Otto?
I'd like to move that while we're at three.
We can't get to that again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am Otto Wilson, Director of Oregon Retail Council, a division of Associated Oregon Industry. Speaking on House Bill 2284, first I should say that I'm going to speak from some notes, and I will summarize my remarks in print in order that you may have them, and I'm particularly anxious that Representative Katz may have them also. I do object to the apparent presumption that all price variations of the nature being discussed in this bill are an attempt to deceive on the part of either the retailer or the producer. perhaps because it does differ from the usual expectation that you have a unit price advantage in a larger quantity. And certainly I do not condone, and I'm sure most of the retailers that I represent in the state of Oregon do not condone deceptive marketing practices. For example, marking a large package economy size when actually the unit price is higher. And I know that there are those who will deceive in every line of endeavor, and if I may be facetious, even legislators and lobbyists. But I do want to assure you that we can't legislate morality, and that public censure is the ultimate weapon in this respect. House Bill 2284 does ignore the natural variations in prices which are related to production, handling, and packaging costs in some instances. These may vary due to volume, the type of process, the style of the package, and other factors. An item may be priced more per unit in a larger package because engineering cost surveys show the process of providing the finished product is more expensive in that size, and so the price is at a higher level. In some instances, the relative cost of a container is greater when it's purchased in small quantities, although that particular container might be a larger size package. Processing larger containers also may require more expensive handling costs. For example, in some instances, large packages are hand-packed when the large volume smaller packages are run on a machine. The consumer actually determines the ultimate pricing of these items by his preference. The item that he purchases in quantity is ultimately going to have a lower price because of the volume that is attained. And some other sizes, whether they be large or small, may cost more because they are handled in very small quantities. And a couple of interesting things might happen, and I wish you would consider them, if 2284 is passed. It might bring to the consumer fewer choices, because both the producer and the retailer might decide that it just isn't worth the hassle. And so he will not offer the small quantity, odd size items for the small number of buyers, but rather eliminate it from his shelf. I'm a little reluctant to point out a flaw in the proposal, but it states that if they are of the same brand, and so the simple foil is to change the brand name on the other package. And somebody might do that. There actually are items that cost more in the unit level per ounce in the large package than they do in the small. And some examples might be offered, and there are probably many more, and I haven't personally gone into the grocery store to survey it myself. But salmon and tuna and minced chicken and minced ham are typical items where the consumer has set the pace by buying a particular size because that's a convenient serving size style. In your own family, you probably buy a 6.5 ounce can of tuna most of the time because that's a nice quantity to use for a recipe or to make sandwiches. And most people don't like to have much left over because it doesn't really keep well. And so, by far the most tuna is sold in a 6.5 ounce can. But some producers do pack a larger can, and this may appear at a higher per ounce cost because it doesn't run through the mass production line. It's packed in a slower process with more hand labor, and as the producer evaluates his production costs, he applies those higher charges to that product. Another example, sometimes a large jumbo cake of soap is produced as a novelty item for Christmas time or Valentine. Well, it's expensive to produce that in that special package, that special size. And so it will cost more than the same soap would in the smaller quantity. Some producers and some retailers absorb the difference in these costs because they feel that it is a good public relations move. But I think it would be unfair by statute to create a rigid requirement that this may be done. I might also just mention that, you know, the reverse can be true. A very small package can be much more expensive to make than a large package because it's a custom item and requires more hand attention. Now, Section 3, Paragraph 1 bothers me. I think I know what it means, but I'm not sure, and I think it should be stated in a little different way so that we all were certain of what it meant. But again, it bothers me, how is this to be administered? And how is it to be enforced? We're placing a layer of administration, again, upon the retailer in an effort to discourage a very few people from abusing, and we're restricting all of those who are honest and sincere merchants. Seems to me that this is another one of the many instances where the prescribed remedy becomes a problem in itself. I don't believe there ever has been and that there ever will be a more sensitive, a more accurate, or a more compelling regulation than the collective opinion of the buyer. Seems to me that overregulation such as this really benefits only those people who enjoy the process of doing it. And I suggest that you don't make the choice for the buyer, but that you let the buyer decide for himself. A question was asked earlier, and I might refer to it, are there items that are priced higher wholesale in the larger package than in the smaller, and yes, there are. Again, I say it's going to be an extremely difficult thing to administer and to enforce, and the public really has the greatest regulatory power at its command. I'd be glad to try to answer any questions you might have.
Representative Moore.
Yes, in Section 2, on line 19, commented on the term of the same brand name, and I interpreted that there could be the situation arise in which perhaps maybe the brand name would change to circumvent this situation.
I referred to that earlier.
Isn't there plenty of laws on the books now to cover that kind of situation when you're dealing with brand names, with the names of the product?
I don't really know, Representative Morris. It seems to me that there are just, I can think of many items that are packed at the same, by the same producer with many different labels.
Can you answer that? Do you have any idea?
Food products, frozen foods, canned foods, bottled foods, many of them are packed on the same production line out of the same batch and three or four or five different labels will go on at the end.
We check into them, find out what.
I don't think there's anything to prevent me from producing a product in one size and calling it carnation soap, and in another size and calling it rose soap.
Okay, I misinterpreted you. I thought you were changing brand names that were existing on cans.
No, but if the producer wants to circumvent this,
he
simply, instead of calling it Bumblebee tuna when it's in a 24-ounce package, he can call it Christmas tuna.
Okay, I'm here. I'm here.
Andy Rogers. Yes.
Mr. Wilson, aren't there federal laws that have to do with things misleading and tightened down?
Deceptive trade practices.
We've seen all these signs say mood, et cetera, et cetera. Economy size. Now, does that fall within the purview of existing federal regulations?
I'm not qualified to answer that, sir. I said at the outset that I don't condone it, and I don't think most merchants do. And yet it is done. It is done.
A legitimate thing.
But I think this is a rather oblique way to get at it.
Go ahead. Mr. Wilson, I can sympathize with you and think some of the problems that you see here. I think it gets back to the old ball game that I call the delinquent few, that we find problems like this occurring. And remedies such as this are brought forward, or at least reported to be remedies. We get testimony as to why it should be done, because we have here some examples of some of the problems that legislation like this creates. And we have testimony that tells us of the problems that the legislation creates. Your testimony, like others that I have heard in related matters, brings out these problems that the legislation creates and says that this is just going to create problems for the honest, everyday type of person, and it will not really remedy the situation with the delinquent few. That isn't precisely what you said. I think what I would like to ask is how you would see that we could resolve these problems in other ways, other than maybe through legislation. I know that most organizations, such as yourself, do some policing and try to see to it that your industry remains above board. And but yet we still have these problems. I'm curious what your suggestion would be to really get in and correct these things, if not through legislation. Or if, indeed, we can do it with legislation, what kind?
First of all, sir, I'm concerned that more and more, and particularly in the last 12 years, we have turned to a philosophy of using legislation as a means of trying to provide character, honesty, morality, and I think it's a futile effort. Now, I don't mean to say that we don't need legislation to protect those that are abused, but there must be some guidelines in legislation, but within those guidelines, people must behave according to ethics, honesty, character, love, and other compelling forces, or man can't live together. And I am concerned, and very seriously concerned, about the preponderance of attitude that somehow we're going to make everybody behave by law. And I don't think we can. I don't think this law will stop the person from being dishonest if he really is bent on doing so. The real rotten guy is still going to find a way to gyp the buyer. In answer to your first question, what would I suggest? Well, I presume you've thought of through the same things that I have, that ideally industry should police itself. Industry and business should police itself. And this is done rather effectively sometimes. Certainly not to the extent that most of us would desire. But again, I point out that many times in an effort to reach this bad cue that you mentioned, our cure, our remedy, our prescription penalizes everybody. And I don't believe it's equitable. We're always going to have some problems. And sometimes the problems such as we have with a few people, using this as an illustration, a few people misrepresenting items may not be near as bad as putting everybody in a straitjacket under the mistaken notion that it's going to stop dishonesty.
Okay. Have you seen it?
No, I have not.
Now the particular stores that are mentioned here are, to my best way of thinking, are very reputable organizations, good neighbors, all of the things that I would consider that they should be in my personal dealings with them and others. Now these aren't possibly gross attempts to deceive the public. I don't know that these are, I don't believe that these are examples of where it said giant economy size or other pieces of advertisements or literature that would designate them as such. But I think the bill trying to get to these particular cases such as this, which may not be necessarily be meant to be deceitful.
The thing that we don't know here, of course, why are they priced as they are? And it's wrong for us to make the assumption that there's something phony in the works. We would have to know what production and packaging costs were, what handling costs were, what turnover was. There are so many things involved in arriving at a final price. And I'm not saying, because I don't know, sir. I don't know the facts, and I don't think you do either. And I don't think the people that got this information. And if we're really going to make a judgment, then we should find out from the people who know, the people who produce the item, why is it priced this way? And it might very well be that, for example, the package cost in one of these larger items is just more expensive.
We're planning on sending a letter to both these organizations with this sheet and asking them why.
Now, they may be guilty of sin, and I'm not going to defend them because I don't know. But I think it is sinful to deem them guilty when you don't know the facts.
I might say maybe that's why we have the hearings on it.
No, but too often we stop at this point and don't go any further. I'd be glad to offer any assistance I can in reaching these people because we do have ready access to their communication.
referring to the Tide laundry detergent example that's in front of you, irrespective of packaging costs, wholesale costs, producers' motive or retailers' motive, the fact is that we have a discrepancy that will mislead the buyer. Because we assume, most buyers assume that the larger package they buy, they get it cheaper per ounce. Now, you've couched most of what you've testified here to an immorality, character, honesty, and that sort of thing, but does it make any difference to the consumer what is in the seller's heart if he pays more per ounce in a larger package? He's been misled, even if he's been innocently misled.
Well, he's been misled because he has wrongly assumed that always a large package is cheaper than a small one. And
hasn't.
Maybe it's an educational process. And as I said, I don't believe that it is proper to label this package in a manner that would indicate that this is a cheaper way to buy.
But hasn't he been misled by most of the producers, though, in forming this? Have you ever seen a package that was labeled small, uneconomical stuff?
Well, you wouldn't expect that to be done, and probably you wouldn't do it if you were in business.
Okay. Now, you also mentioned one of your objections was there would be fewer choices. Now, in the Tide laundry detergent that's used as an example here, we have four choices: 20, 49, 84, and 171 ounces. And now, if I read this chart correctly, the 84 ounce is the one that is deceptively packaged, or at least its price not in proportion to the size, which I take it then would mean there would be three sizes available instead of four. And that's your objection?
Well, one never knows. We don't know from this information what volume they sell in each item, nor how much it costs them to produce it. But ultimately, and there will be a lag, one of these items might be just new on the market, another one might be just going out. But ultimately, the only ones that are going to stay on the shelf are the ones that people buy.
But the purpose of this legislation, though, is to see, if I interpret it correctly, that the more you buy, or at least if you buy more, you have at least the right to know you won't be paying more per ounce. Isn't that right? Because we would eliminate any packages that were contrary to that. You just couldn't sell them.
The consumer just would not have the opportunity to buy that type of item.
Right. So he
and Representative Katz said when she was here that she just couldn't imagine why any item would ever be priced that way. Well, are we going to look at the facts that there is a legitimate reason why an item might be priced higher because of higher production costs, handling costs, packaging costs? Are we going to ignore that?
No, but that's not. Does that matter?
Or are we going to say to the producer that he can't merchandise a package that would result in a price differential?
That's exactly what the bill says.
Then you're saying to the customer, we are not going to let you have your choice. We're going to make the choice for you. And I don't think that is in keeping with our way of life.
Well, I need my question answered. But one, do you think maybe that the merchant, for example, if the wholesale price is directly in proportion to these prices, we pass a state law, the stuff's manufactured, shipped in from out of the state, it's obvious that we're penalizing the local merchant. And so don't you think, I know what I would do if I was a merchant, and I'm not afraid to say it, I'd make sure that the prices were all the same, and I'd make sure I was covered. If that meant raising the low prices a little bit to cover it,
right.
Okay. Because why should a state law force a penalty upon a local merchant when he has absolutely no control? You know, I guess it's not a question. Don't you think a merchant would do that, though?
Certainly would. And further, how are you going to determine what's happening? I'd like to ask the committee that. How do you conceive that the state is going to determine what has taken place? Are we going to set up an elaborate investigating and administering and policing force? I think that we may be overestimating the size of the problem.
Mr. Wilson, in theory at least, and I haven't been in business, I can't
first-hand knowledge. But whether it's a mom-and-pop, quote-unquote, grocery store, or Crown Zellerbach, or General Motors, the theory, as I have interpreted, is that if you buy in quantity, that you get a reduced price. One of the reasons that I have heard so often that, that small businesses, grocery stores, haven't survived, the mom and pop type stores, the little neighborhood store, haven't survived because they can't buy in volume. As such as Fred Meyer's or the large chain stores. So therefore their prices are higher, people don't buy from them, they can go to Fred Meyer's around the corner and buy cheaper. The same holds true, I think, with any manufacturer. They buy in quantities and get a reduced price. Their suppliers sell to them and say, I can get, send you 100,000 quarter-inch bolts for this price, but if you buy it in a 500,000 lot, I can give it to you at 20% discount. I believe that's kind of the theory.
There may be exceptions, but generally that certainly is true. And it's that very principle that I'm talking about.
Okay.
The quantity production of an item is what makes it possible to sell it at a lower price than the lesser quantity in a larger package.
It boggles my mind why it can't be delivered back to the consumer the same way.
Well, let's suppose, let's take an example.
I can see acceptance. Now, you made a remark here a little while ago that you wanted to ask us, me, a question about how we enforce something like this. And in reply to that, I don't think it's my place to answer questions like that right now. I'm here to ask you questions, so maybe later I can come up with those answers.
Well, I wasn't saying that facetiously, but it's difficult for me to understand how the bill will affect the retailers of the state of Oregon, the producers of the state of Oregon, if I don't have some idea about how this is going to be enforced. And if we can't enforce it, then we've not accomplished anything.
I tend to agree with you on that. But again, I think first I want to find out some facts, your opinion, a lot of others, and some good solid facts about this bill and what it says. And then, again, maybe get into this idea of how you police it. I agree with you. But I think the first thing first.
Any other questions?
Thank you very much, Tim.
Okay, the last one to sign up on 2284, so we'll jump on to 2272. Ronald Tippy. Did I pronounce that right?
Right.
You got a good man here. You told me how.
Very good.
Point seven.
2272. Good afternoon. I'm Ron Tempe, Assistant Vice President of Standard Insurance Company in Portland, Oregon, with actuarial responsibilities for life insurance, annuities, and disability income insurance sold to individuals. I am a fellow of the Society of Actuaries and a member of the American Academy of Actuaries. House Bill 2272 amends ORS 746.015, which relates to unfair discrimination by prohibiting discrimination between individuals solely by reason of the sex of the individual. It would state that men and women shall be considered of the same class. The addition of a mere 39 words, I counted them.
I don't like the sound of it either.
The section 746.015 would have very significant ramifications in the insurance industry. It is my premise that it would be disruptive without resulting gain, and that one of the basic principles of insurance is violated. Over half of the insurance in force is with mutual insurance companies. This means that the companies are owned by their policy owners rather than by stockholders. A mutual insurance company is charged, often through a charter or bylaws, with the responsibility of treating its policy owners equitably. Further, the insurance commissioners of most states have the responsibility of enforcing equitable treatment of all policy owners in insurance companies operating in their states. And additionally, there have been suits against insurance companies regarding whether or not dividends and the resulting cost of insurance was being handled in an equitable manner. Equitable treatment of policy owners requires the classification of risks of insured into homogeneous risk units with equal expectation of claims. The classifications should recognize all statistically significant characteristics which develop different patterns of claim or different levels of claim, ignoring a distinguishing characteristic which is identifiable and material would be an injustice and in violation of a basic principle of insurance and in violation of most state insurance laws.
Yes.
Yes. You want copies of it?
Yeah.
Well, you have it, sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Thank you.
You want to just pass that down? I guess if you want to follow along, I'm starting with the second paragraph on the second page. Excuse me for not passing it out before. Again, with the second paragraph on the second page, statistical information will be given later, which clearly indicates the sex of an insured is a distinguishing characteristic in terms of the level of anticipated claim and should be reflected in the premium charge. There are basic biological differences which produce these claim differences. Legislation prohibiting one type of distinction, that is, the sex of the insured, leaves open the possibility of legislative action to eliminate other significant characteristics such as the age of the insured, and I know that you all know how significant age would be in the pricing of life insurance or annuities. Also, the health of the insured, a potential insured's occupation, or the pursuit of a dangerous avocation are distinguishing characteristics which must be considered for appropriate classification of risk. Currently, females pay a lower cost for life insurance, but a higher cost for annuities and health insurance. Recently promulgated Insurance Commissioner Regulation 61 requires there be no premium difference between males and females unless demonstrably based on credible supporting data. Under this circumstance, most insurance companies have a strong desire to market coverages which meet the life, health, and annuity needs of both sexes, which reflect the premium differences or the claim differences. A requirement to charge equal premiums to males and females could have a significant impact on the enthusiasm to market some types of coverages to females. There certainly would be problems in establishing correct premiums. Furthermore, sound operation of an insurance company would still need to recognize the mixture of female and male risks in order to appropriately set premium rates and establish reserves for future benefit payments. This would be the case even though a premium distinction could not be made. As an example of this, if a company sold annuities guaranteeing payments for a person's lifetime, an annuity, it would be vitally necessary for the company to consider the sex of the annuitant. If the annuities were priced, assuming only males were receiving benefits, they could operate with a relatively low premium schedule. However, the premium schedule and the reserves required for future payments would be inadequate if females started to purchase the benefit. The low premium, primarily set for males, would attract female applicants, and as a greater proportion of females started receiving benefits, the premium rates would need to be increased. They would then be less favorable for males in order to price the anticipated longevity for females, and there would be an escalating proportion of the annuities being paid to females. Thus, as the proportion of male and female applicants change, it would be necessary to adjust the premium rates accordingly. In summary, the sex of the insured or annuitant cannot be ignored if an insurance company is to operate soundly. The sex will be recognized even if it is required that one premium be charged for both sexes by attempting to anticipate the proportion of males and females to receive the benefit. It's difficult for me to determine that any type of additional equity is being served in this type of premium determination. The same type of situation applies to life and health insurance as well as annuities, which we've just gone through. The insurance industry has many highly scientific, refined studies of claim experience, particularly with respect to life insurance, annuities, disability income insurance, and health insurance. The experience is generally studied by grouping data in a variety of ways to determine the characteristics which develop different levels or patterns of claims. Certainly, the sex of the insured or annuitant has been a characteristic which has provided measurable and significant differences in experience. The Society of Actuaries regularly studies reports and reports experience under life, health insurance, and annuities. A good example of new tables is the recently developed 1971 individual annuity mortality table and 1971 group annuity mortality table, reported in volume 33 of the Transactions of the Society of Actuaries. On page 496 of this volume, we find a table of male and female mortality rates. As an example of the mortality differences, it is shown that a rate per thousand of 26.000 for males and a rate of 14.029 for females. Mortality for males outdistancing female mortality by almost 2-1. Another example is in the report in this 1971 publication of the Society of Actuaries on Disability Income Insurance. The ratio of female to male claim costs for the first year of benefits with a 30-day elimination period is 250% of the young issue ages, or young ages, and 264, 204, and 125% as the age advances. Female claim costs being considerably higher than male claim costs. It would be financially unsound, and actually totally irresponsible from an actuarial viewpoint, to not recognize the experience differences for males and females. Females live longer, and this would result in the cost for an annuity being higher than for males. Conversely, since females live longer, it would require that life insurance for females be lower cost than for males. The current ORS 746.015 prohibits unfair discrimination. Proper pricing of life insurance, health insurance, and annuities assumes differentiations or classifications or discriminations of risk based on age, health history, allocation, medical findings, sex, etc. The insuring system would be seriously impaired if these discriminations could not be made. Homogeneous classifications of risk is a basic insuring principle. Concludes the fair technique.
We're talking about sex discrimination in insurance. You're relating principally to life insurance, and I would assume also to health insurance, correct?
Life insurance, disability income insurance, and annuity would be the area that I feel capable of speaking in.
Not being involved with insurance, are we having problems, quote, unquote, problems?
of discrimination by sex with other forms of insurance?
I would guess there'd be other people that would be. If I may, I'll answer. We're being discriminated against the male, yeah. Because actuarially and with their race, we're a bigger risk than the female.
So, but
right, Frank?
Are we going to be given the problem of sex discrimination in the total spectrum of insurance from liability onward to liability insurance? We've got to get those. Because I'm unfamiliar with it.
You mean, no, I'm not sure. You mean.
Well, we have, quote unquote, the problem of sex discrimination in insurance. Now, is this a problem that runs the gauntlet of insurance, or is it primarily a problem, quote unquote, of health insurance, life insurance?
Yes. Exactly what he's been telling you. They use the same type of route to figure out automobile insurance or any other type of insurance. Same thing.
If it's a distinguishing characteristic in the setting of premium, I would guess this would apply in all this.
Right.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Is there anybody here to testify in favor of this bill?
No.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I move we table House Bill 2272.
If there's anybody in support of it, I'll accept that motion. Thank you.
Your male children are.
No.
David?
Aye.
Warren?
Aye.
Brighton?
Aye.
Roman?
Aye.
Winner?
Aye.
Okay, good. The other two gentlemen aren't too upset that they get satisfied in the next one. 2276.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Frank Howitt. I'm Assistant Insurance Commissioner for the State of Oregon. The insurance code is the whole body of law in the Oregon Revised Statutes intended for the protection of the insurance buying public. The insurance commissioner administers these laws. It deals with all phases of insurance, including specific provisions with regard to discriminations, policy benefits, fairness, what have you. The insurance commissioner's office is specially designed to function in this area. It seems to us that it is not only superfluous but mischievous to put the regulation of insurance under a law such as this public accommodations law. We do not believe that insurance fits there, that the people administering that law are experts in the field of insurance. We believe we are fully capable to respond to the needs of the insurance buying public in any area that the public accommodations law would reach to. And I respectfully urge that the committee not pass the House Bill 2276.
Isn't this bill the same as the bill that is tabled? It's along the same lines. They're talking about discrimination and insurance.
Well, I'm not.
As insurance, the definition of a place in public accommodation for purpose of family discrimination. To me, it seems like almost the same thing.
That
seems like it accomplishes the same purpose at the end.
I think that the motivation of the sponsor is probably the same in both bills.
Thank you.
I might just add to that, though. I would consider it far preferable to pass House Bill 2272 and let the insurance commissioner enforce it than putting this bill into effect and letting the Bureau of Labor or somebody try to figure out what should be done.
If I'm not mistaken, I like the ORS, that is, that was 30675, isn't it?
putting you under the Bureau of Labor for the purpose of discrimination? Any other questions, Frank?
Thank you.
Any more testimony on this one?
We have one more again. No more, Don?
I'm Don Delzer. I represent the insurance, Safeco Insurance Company. I am the First Alliance underwriting manager, and I deal with things such as automobile and home insurance. I'm opposed to House Bill 2276 on the basis that 75 to 85% of the people in Oregon today pay lower insurance premiums due to the fact that insurance companies do discriminate between individuals who are likely to have losses and those who are not likely to have losses. This bill would prohibit this kind of discrimination and require insurance to be sold to all applicants at the same price. We do not think it is fair that people who rarely, if ever, have losses should have to pay the same premium and the same prices as those who have frequent losses. While it is discriminatory to distinguish between them, we do not think it is unfair to do so. We support the existing statute that permits discrimination but prohibits unfair discrimination. If this bill is passed, the net result would be general rate increases for the vast majority of Oregonians. We think this is unfair and not in the best interest of the general public. I have, for your interest, a study that was extracted from a study done by the Motor Vehicle Department of the State of Oregon for the four-year period of 1968 to 1971, published in January of 1973. As you will note, 70.8% of the drivers in the state of Oregon had no accidents of any kind, chargeable or non-chargeable, fault or not at fault, in the four-year period between 1968 and 1971. Only 0.2% of the drivers had five or more accidents. And yet, if this bill were passed, the industry would be required to charge everyone the same price. We believe that that is not fair. Is there any questions?
Any questions?
Single adult males under 25 do pay more.
You take the sex thing out of the actuary, and then the single female would be paying more.
That's true. If you are interested, I had prepared to testify on House Bill 2272, and I have another display that might be of value to you in considering that.
Maybe
bill.
We need it self-defense.
This particular bit of information was copied out of a publication of the Motor Vehicle Division published in June of 1974 titled 1972 Accident and Violation Analysis for Licensed Oregon Drivers. If you turn to the second page of that display, you will note that the top line of the graph displays the accident per 1,000 male drivers. The bottom line displays the accidents per 1,000 female drivers. And as you can see, particularly in the ages between 15 and 25, there is a marked difference in the number of accidents per 1,000 drivers. And once again, if this bill becomes law, we would be forced to charge all of these people the same price.
Representative Wilhelm's going to say something.
Mr. Chairman, is there anybody here to testify in favor of this bill?
No, there isn't.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move to the table House Bill 2276.
Second. The table. Agnes?
Aye.
Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
Mark?
Aye.
Brian?
Aye.
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 table. I will move on to 2388. Now we're getting some of the people in favor.
Yeah.
You got 4:30. Okay, we'll have a 10-minute recess.